Welcome to The Agent Secret. My name's Georgie Wolfenden, and this is the show that is dedicated to making you feel your best, whatever your age. On this episode of The Agent Secret, I'm delighted to be speaking to Dr. Federica Amati, who is a nutritional scientist and expert in women's health. She'll be discussing with us how we can move through the menopause with ease. Hi, it's Dr. Federica.
Hi, Georgie. So good to be here. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I've been better, actually, as I'm in the full flux of the menopause, so I'm quite excited to let women know how they can better prepare for the menopause.
That's what it's all about.
And I'm sure you've got lots of clients of this age category who are going through that thing.
Yeah.
And suffering with various different kind of elements and symptoms. Can you kind of take us into what is the menopause?
Yeah. So the menopause is one of those rare medical conditions which is actually retrospectively decided. So the day of menopause is a moment in time, but we only know that you got there a year later because we talk about menopause as being a year after your last period. Mm-hmm. The perimenopause spans the time between when your symptoms start, when all the hormones start fluctuating and we get the symptoms of menopause, until the year after your last period.
Yeah.
So really, perimenopause is the span of time, but the menopause is just a moment in that time.
Yeah.
And it really varies between women, how they experience this change. But generally, it happens to most women globally between the age of 47 and 51. Mm. In the UK and the US and Australia, it's 51. In countries like India, it's a bit earlier, 47. And we think that's due to genetic factors and environmental factors as well. And I think worth noting here that some women will go through menopause because of surgery or chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And others may go through early menopause, premature menopause. And that can happen so before the age of 40, and then fewer still before the age of 35, and fewer still before the age of 30.
Okay.
But it does happen. So it's also worth knowing what the symptoms are in case you are actually going through menopause but you don't think you're old enough yet.
Exactly. Yeah. And what are your clients? What are the main struggles or concerns?
The main symptoms, So it really, again, it's very personal as to what symptoms you're going to experience. And I always think it's interesting with my clients, I've noticed that women who generally struggled more with PMS or with pregnancy symptoms tend to have stronger menopause symptoms.
Yeah.
And to me, that makes sense. It's a sign of how responsive your body is to hormone change.
Yeah.
And the most well-known and sort of well-understood symptoms are hot flushes, anxiety, changes in libido, changes in sleep.
Yeah, my sleep's gone off the...
Has it?
Yeah. Difficult.
You're running on air, basically.
I'm running on air,
But there's lots of other ones that are less well-known, like skin rashes, and also heart palpitations are quite common.
Yeah.
And they're actually quite scary to experience, especially if you're suffering with heart palpitations and anxiety at the same time, then you know, one step away from a panic attack, essentially. Yeah. And then there's some women who really don't... Some women have very bizarre symptoms. So one of my clients, her hair went straight. She has curly hair.
Okay.
And her hair just went dead straight for a year. And then it went curly again. And the only thing she could correlate it to was
the hormonal difference.
Yeah, the hormonal changes. Okay. So if we think that as women, we have estrogen receptors all over our bodies, in our brains, everywhere. Of course, when the hormones start doing this roller coaster, it impacts every single tissue on our body.
Yeah.
But which symptom you're going to have is hard to predict.
Yeah.
But there's a whole host, a whole variety of symptoms. I actually outline them in a diagram in my new book.
Okay. What's your book called?
Recipes for a Better Menopause, coming out in October for Menopause Month. So I'm really, I've got a diagram in there with the most common ones for early perimenopause, menopause and postmenopause.
Fantastic. Yeah. So that leads us on nicely. I think women really struggle with what should I be eating? What should I be eating more of? Are there things that you think are really helpful with different symptoms?
Yes. So the science on menopause and nutrition isn't amazing. There isn't like a whole lot of science. And that's because investing in science for the menopause is only recent. So it's finally become more of an agenda item. There's way more interest, which means that now research is being done.
Yeah.
The best study that we have to date on nutrition and menopause is the Zoe Menopause Study.
Yeah.
And
which you're involved in.
Yes, and which you know well as well, because you kind of did the PR for it. So it's a really good study because it shows us how closely linked nutritional status is with menopause symptom severity.
Yeah.
So what we learned from that study and then from other studies that have been done as well all over the world is that actually what we eat and what nutritional status we're in does impact the severity of our symptoms. It doesn't necessarily impact which symptoms we get though. So if you're somebody who is going to get hot flashes. We can't necessarily say that eating a specific food will get rid of them.
Okay.
But there seems to be enough evidence to say that specific dietary patterns in foods can help reduce the severity so that you can carry on with your life. And there's some really nice evidence around movement as well. So I'm not an exercise expert, but the scientific evidence shows us that movement, daily movement, really helps with the severity of symptoms as well. Okay. So combining those two things together, they're things we do every day.
Yeah.
We move every day, we eat every day. And the third one I think we have to mention is alcohol.
Yeah.
Alcohol really isn't a menopausal woman's friend.
No.
And the severity of symptoms is so much worse in women who drink more.
Okay.
So it's worth reining that in if you are suffering with symptoms and also just for health, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about going back to the kind of food stuff and things you can do? I mean, I started taking, you know, more mushrooms and felt the mood was completely different.
Yeah.
And I remember I emailed you, I was like, why is this happening? So I think it's really interesting that you can have that switch if it's a mood link. And why are the, I know there's been a lot around mushrooms in the press, but why are the mushrooms helping, you know, perimenopausal menopausal women?
I think, well, I think mushrooms help everyone, to be honest with you. So what people say to me, like, what is some advice that applies to pretty much almost everybody, and that is eat more mushrooms, eat more whole grains, and have some probiotic foods in your diet. Like if people actually did those, and pulses and beans, the fourth. If people actually did that every day, we would be in a much better place as a society with our health.
Okay.
And mushrooms have this very special place in our food pyramid, say, because they are unique. They're more genetically similar to us than they are to plants. They're not actually a plant.
Okay.
And they have lots of chemicals in them that are specific to mushrooms that we can't find in any other food. And they provide fiber. They provide these specific polyphenols, these phytochemicals that are really helpful for us. And they have had, there's some research to show that they can really particularly help with immunity and brain function. So turkey tail mushroom is the most well-researched and it has a modulatory effect. It really improves outcomes for breast cancer, which is crazy. It's amazing, like clinical trials, you know? So functional mushrooms are having more and more research done on them because of this interest in how are they helping? What are they doing? But at the moment, you know, I always say if you like mushrooms and if you enjoy eating them, add them to your diet. If you prefer supplementing with the powdered mushrooms, that's also a great idea. And for women going through the menopause who are perimenopausal, having that extra fiber and that extra polyphenol, we know that that's helpful for symptoms.
And do you have a preference over the powder or eating mushrooms?
So I like to eat them every day.
Okay.
I try to eat them every day. I do have mushroom powder at home, but I prefer to get my benefits from food. Than I do from supplements are there for the days that I know I'm going to be running around all day.
Okay.
Might not have exactly the food I want to eat.
Yeah.
But I don't think we have enough data yet to say exactly which functional mushrooms you should be focusing on.
Okay.
So if you are somebody who likes functional mushroom powders, I think take a mix.
Okay.
Because we're not sure exactly whether one of them is better than the other or whether a higher dose is necessarily better.
I think my doses are just going up and up as I'm leading more into the menopause.
Of that. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So be careful of that. Keep it mixed. Variety is key. And eating mushrooms in your food is delicious and good for you. So do that as well. Sunbathe them a bit on your windowsill for the vitamin D.
Yeah.
They make it for us.
Fantastic.
So it's good.
And what's your views on, there's been a lot about, you know, how we should be testing. There's been a lot about the Dutch test or how early should women be testing?
Yeah, so I think the thing about testing for hormones is that it gives you a snapshot in time.
Yeah.
And in the perimenopause, our hormones are all over the place.
Yeah.
So getting one snapshot doesn't necessarily tell you anything. So you could go in and have a test and your estrogen might be really, really low at that moment in time. And the next, and your doctor or somebody who's looking at the data might think, oh, you're already menopausal.
Yeah.
Like there's no estrogen there. Your progesterone's also like, you know, dip down again. So it's just about, actually, we need to build up a picture of what's normal, ideally before your perimenopausal.
Okay.
And this idea of going in and testing throughout your cycle so you know what the variations are. So like, what is our normal cycle look like? And then when you go to testing hormones later, you can see like, okay, this doesn't look like any of the previous data. I think that's what we're moving towards. So Hertility Health by Helen O'Neill, her company, they're doing a great job of prioritizing like women's testing.
How early is early, Fed? It's like 35 I think 30-ish, and upwards.
Yeah, 35 upwards.
And regular testing.
Regular, and being mindful that when you're, if you do have children, pregnancy messes up your hormones and post-pregnant. So like building up a picture with data for as long as possible gives you more insight. But at the moment, if you speak to any menopause doctor, so like the GPs who specialise, all the ones I work with, they say the best thing to do is to ask a woman about how she feels.
Yeah.
Because the biggest change, as I said, some women don't really get many symptoms, so it's not an issue if your hormones are low. If you've gone through
good,
the menopause and you feel good,
okay.
Why do we need to medicalise that? It's not about the hormone levels. It is about how a woman feels. What is she reporting? What is actually affecting her?
Mm.
That's what's interesting. And that's what we should be basing our decisions on.
Rather than the bloods.
Yeah.
Testing.
Yeah.
Really,
I think the testing can be helpful. And I think also another point to note here is that just because your estrogen, your progesterone aren't what they were when you were 25, they shouldn't be by the time you're 50.
That's normal at that point.
And we don't want to bring women in their 50s to the same hormone levels as when they were 25.
Yeah.
Biologically, that doesn't make sense. We don't want that. Do we want to maybe, if necessary, if it's medically indicated, if you go into early menopause, there are benefits of having a lower dose of estrogen and progesterone to help protect your bones, to help protect your mental health and your cardiovascular system. If you've had your womb removed, actually that changes as well. So it's all a balancing act. And it's a really good idea to speak to somebody who's very, very well versed in deciding what's best medically for HRT.
Yeah.
But not everybody has to go in it. That is not the only answer to menopause.
I think it's difficult as well, because every doctor, I've seen so many doctors just look at whether I need HRT, and they all say very different things.
Yeah.
So I think that's really challenging for women.
Yeah, it is. And I think this is where I think person-centred care is so important. Like, do you want to go on HRT? Is that something you'd like to do?
I've got it in my drawer and it's there and it's like calling me. But then all the tests are saying, you don't need it. But I want it, because I think surely that would be good for my hair and good for my skin. But,
I mean, you have great hair and skin. but I think it depends on the person. There's some women I work with, they're like, I'm not interested. I don't want to take it. And I'm like, okay, cool, that's cool. And then some women come to me and they say, I'd like to take it. So I refer them on to a menopause specialist who can prescribe HRT. But I think taking a measured approach and making sure that it's what the person wants.
Yeah.
There are, I think, it's problematic, people saying that the only solution, the answer is, calling the menopause just an estrogen deficiency.
Yeah.
I think that's a bit unhelpful.
Yeah.
Because
it's gone so the other way now, hasn't it? Whereas before it was HRT and there was that study that maybe was flawed.
It was very flawed, yeah.
And then now everyone's kind of just dishing out loads of
estrogen. Dishing it out, even
when
people don't want it. And I think actually, let's take a step back. We also don't have a huge amount of evidence of women who have taken it for 25 years or so.
Yeah.
So if we're all going to start taking HRT at 50 until we're about 100, which are expected life expectancy, right? That's 50 years.
Yeah.
Do we have data for that? No. Do we know what happens? Not really. Can we guess? We can, but let's just take it case by case, see how someone feels, and do the best we can with other lifestyle and diet interventions to support our health for like a long and happy life. Whenever people say to me, sometimes when I speak to doctors about this, they're like, well, yeah, but don't you think, longevity will be improved? And I think, look at the blue zones. Yeah. None of those 114-year-old ladies are taking HRT.
Yeah, exactly.
They're not. So what's keeping them alive for a very long time isn't their estrogen. There are other things.
Other things that come into play.
But if you are one of the people who wants to take HRT and it has a really positive impact on your life, that's great as well.
Yeah, so it's a case-by-case basis,
definitely.
Isn't it?
And year by year and sort of see how you get
monitoring
on.
Monitoring it. It's not like I'm taking this amount of estrogen or whatever, it's going to stick to that exact amount.
And that should be with any drug, right? Any drug that you're prescribed.
Yeah.
Checking in, is it still working for you? Are there side effects that have cropped up? Has something else changed? Like, I think it's really important to go through that process. A lot of the issues we see in elderly people is from polypharmacy. So this idea that they get prescribed a drug and then a drug to counteract the side effect of the drug and then a drug to counteract the side effect of the drug to counteract the... It just becomes this
pill
Jenga
tower.
Exactly. So
my mother-in-law is definitely in that category.
And that's not good.
No.
So we need to avoid that.
Apply the kind of same thing to that. Monitoring how
monitoring, how are you feeling today? Do we need to change anything? Just keep it personal and keep checking up on it and seeing how you're feeling and what the next steps are.
And can we get like estrogens from our food? Can we boost, or is that kind of not true?
So no, there are phytoestrogens in food, especially soy products. And it's not that it's not true. It's just that how much of that food you have to eat to actually impact your estrogen levels.
Okay.
But there's nice evidence to say that eating these foods is beneficial. for menopause symptoms. So there might be something going on there, probably through the gut microbiome, which we don't necessarily understand all of. But I think, again, drinking soy milk or eating edamame, that's all great for us, but it's not going to replace HRT. It's not an HRT.
Okay.
And similarly, if, husbands or sons or partners, they don't need to worry about eating those foods. It's not going to make them estrogenic.
No, exactly. Yeah.
Which is another common myth, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. As we're approaching, perimenopause, what should we be doing to prepare to kind of feel better sustainably for the next kind of, 10, 15 years?
Yeah, so that's where I am. And this is also why I was very happy to write the book. Okay. It was like, this is advice to myself.
Yes.
I think often women around the age of 35, 40, a lot of us have young kids. A lot of us have careers that we're building, or we have really busy home lives, or all of the above. Very stretched. And we often forget to put our health first. Mm-hmm. And actually, this is the time to really lay the foundations for a better transition later. The first thing to think about is our body composition. It massively changes after the menopause if we're not aware of it.
Okay.
So in our 30s, it's still relatively easy to increase our muscle mass. Mm. Now, I'm not talking about going to the gym and becoming like the next female Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Although, sure, if you want to do that, I'm talking about the skeletal muscle, so that core muscle mass that actually keeps us upright. When you see like late ladies in the 90s, and one of them is like walking independently and going upstairs, she's got good skeletal muscle mass left, and that is much easier to build now. You can still build it in your 40s, you can still build it in your 50s, but it becomes more of a maintenance after. So starting with that, so really thinking, okay, have I built my strength up?
And doing that, Fed?
There's two things. There's regular movement throughout our day. So making sure we're mobile, we're walking around, we're not just sitting at a desk all day and then getting in a car and then sitting at home all day. A lot of people do that. And it's become pervasive in society. We're not really aware that we're not moving around anymore. So moving around throughout your day, and then engaging in some sort of weight-bearing exercise. So if you want to go to CrossFit, great. If you want to lift some weights in front of the TV in the evening, that's also great. But just putting some pressure on our muscles to build more muscle.
Yeah.
And that can be doing press-ups at home. It can be, there's so many different ways of doing that. But you do need to have some intensity that helps that muscle growth.
Yeah.
And then the movement. So those two elements. And with our diet, I think we have to remember that the seeds we plant in our 30s with our gut microbiome, with the ability for our metabolism to actually stay healthy.
Yeah.
So a lot of women from age 30 onwards and after the menopause, it's a marked increase, have poorer blood glucose metabolism than men. So our blood glucose control generally isn't great. Not for everyone. There are some women who are very good. But if you're someone who's had type 2 diabetes in the family, or perhaps you had gestational diabetes in pregnancy, you're at higher risk of having poorer glucose metabolism. And what we eat can have a huge impact on whether that becomes a problem, so whether we edge towards insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes, or whether we don't.
Okay.
And I say that because if we can get on top of it in our 30s, then when we do hit the menopause, we're less likely to be insulin resistant.
Okay.
Often it's by the time we're diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, we're already insulin resistant. So, and it's, of course, it's reversible still, but it's much easier if you just don't get there in the first place. So that's something really worth thinking about. And then getting used to eating lots of plants now, when it's hard, when we don't have time, when we have to cook for kids who will only eat beige food and all these other things.
But there's more thing pressuring women
doing
to
that.
Eat more meat protein, isn't there, as well, which is, meat protein. That's always
so
been...
So it's really interesting. I think the messaging around protein's got a bit confused, right?
Okay.
Most people in the UK and the US eat twice their recommended daily amounts.
Yeah.
Like that's just from, we know that that's from national data. Yeah. So we already eat more protein than we need to eat. I think the messaging that is helpful is to say, make sure you think about what protein you're eating first. Now I'll add to that by saying, just choose protein rich plants.
Yeah.
Because protein doesn't have to be fish or chicken or beef. Or any, it can be those things. But if you're already adding in beans, pulses, lentils, whole grains, mushrooms, nuts and seeds, they contain protein. Mm.
So if you're safe, is it to take during that period to not have any meat? Well, if you're quite aware of your protein with plants.
Yeah, so we can get all the essential amino acids from plants.
Okay.
Now, I will flag that vegan diets are more closely associated with mental health issues, okay, depression, anxiety. So I don't think veganism is the answer for everybody. I do think that if you have plenty of protein-rich plants in your diet, which also means you're getting lots of polyphenols and lots of fiber, which is great.
Yeah.
And then you're enjoying oily fish, okay, salmon, trout, mackerel. Salmon and trout contain lots of iron and B12 too.
Okay.
So they're actually really good options. Eggs are amazing. Don't get me started on eggs. Nature's multivitamin. They have everything apart from vitamin C.
But also, I think you crave eggs actually in this period as well, which is weird, isn't it?
But they are nutritionally really complete. So there's other foods we can eat. I personally don't eat meat. It doesn't agree with me. And lots of women actually, lots of my postmenopausal clients say to me, I just don't really want meat anymore.
Yeah.
And that we think could be due to changes in the microbiome.
Yeah.
Which and people find
about
it
before, haven't you?
Yeah.
The microbiome during that period.
So
tell us more about
the Zoe
that.
Menopause study.
Yeah.
Showed that women postmenopausally, their microbiome was so different to premenopausal women that it was actually more similar to the men in the study than to the premenopausal. So there's lots of reasons of why that could be, including that some of our microbes are sensitive to estrogen.
Yeah.
So when that estrogen falls off a cliff,
that
you know the microbes suffer. But so there's lots of reasons why we might go off meat, and I think that's fine. Like, stop eating it if you don't fancy it. And if you do eat meat and fish, you only need like a few portions a week. You don't have to have it at every single meal.
And up our fibre, which we're not doing.
Now fibre is something that 90% of us are deficient in. So everyone's really obsessed with protein and they're adding collagen to their coffee and they're putting this. Now, actually on collagen, I will take that back because there are some very small trials, and I think there'll be more coming out, that show that collagen supplementation after 50 can help with skin elasticity.
And definitely hair, because I had half my head of hair before I took the collagen.
So I think actually... collagen for some reason has a good impact on hair and skin, but it's not really like the protein bit I'm not worried about. So supplementing with protein, like most protein powders and most protein bars are full of crap, so you're better off just eating your beans, your legumes, your mushrooms, your nuts and seeds, having good quality eggs and oily fish. And then if you like to have some chicken or red meat occasionally, that's fine too.
Okay.
But no, we need to stop obsessing. It's just that, but I think what is helpful about the protein message is to start your meal, build your meal from the protein-rich plants instead of from your carbohydrates. Because I think often we're like, I'll have a sandwich with something, or I'll have like pasta with something. Or we start with the carbohydrates.
Yeah. I never wanted the carbs, but now I want that kind of white carb cake. I've never been a cake person.
Yeah, yeah.
But now I want that. It's really weird during this period.
It's not weird if you're tired.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So if we're sleep deprived, one of the biggest effects on our appetite is that we'll crave energy dense foods.
Yeah.
Because we literally like need to hang on to something for dear life.
I need the sugar.
And also stress.
Yeah.
So it's a perfectly normal physiological response to want carbohydrates when our cortisol levels are up.
Right.
Because it helps to dampen the cortisol response. Okay. So those things tie in. But knowing that, you can say, okay, I know I'm tired. I know I've been stressed.
I'm going to step away from the cake
because otherwise, because it's not going to satisfy it. And then on the days when you're like, I really just need that croissant. Okay, that's cool. But let's have, you know, some avocado and smoked salmon before your croissant. So you've had some nutritious foods that help support the rest of the things that are going on. And then have your croissant. So adding food into your diet is much more helpful than trying to deny yourselves the things you want.
Yeah.
Because being in touch with what our body asks for is actually very helpful.
Yeah. More intuitive. So, we've lost the intuition sometimes.
100%.
Everyone's going at a million miles an hour.
Yeah. And we don't give ourselves the time to think, do I want to eat this? Why am I eating this?
Yeah.
Okay, it tastes really great. I'm really excited about it. And then we also have this flip side of like diet culture where we'll avoid the croissant, but then we'll get absolutely starving. And before you know it, you're eating like rice cakes, which do nothing for you.
Yeah.
And then you're even hungrier. And then you get to dinner and you eat like...
too much.
Whatever you can get your hands on because you haven't eaten enough food.
Yeah.
So
in your book,
adding
you've got
food.
Loads of lovely recipes, delicious recipes.
So yeah, so Jane Baxter, because I am no chef. I don't do that. I have other strengths, but that's not it. I love cooking for myself, but you know Italians, I just like throw this in, a little bit of that. If anyone asks me any quantities, I'm like, just a sprinkle. So Jane Baxter, who is a brilliant chef, and she does all the Riverford cookbooks, and she's got a really beautiful restaurant in Devon. Called Wild Artichoke, I think it's called, yeah. So she wrote the recipes and we sort of worked together and made sure that it had loads of different plants in it, lots of fiber in all the recipes, some really great nutritious foods, some delicious protein sources, and they look great and they taste amazing.
Yeah. I think that's going to be really helpful for busy women, just to have like a structure that they can, at that age, just do that and they know it's good for them.
Yeah, so I mean, really the plan of the book is that you can read the science and then apply it with your food.
Yeah.
So all in one.
Easy.
Because originally we were both writing our own books, and then our publisher, who is brilliant, she said, actually, would you guys like to work together?
Yeah.
And I thought, well, yeah, of course.
It's
how great for two women to be working on a book for women. So, yeah.
So, Fed, there's lots of doctors saying we should be eating more protein as we approach perimenopause and when we're menopausal. What's your kind of view on that?
So I think the messaging is positive, but the way it's been picked up isn't. So there isn't a lot of evidence. In fact, there's no evidence to say that any of us are protein deficient. We, in the US and the UK, on average, we eat twice as much protein as we need to maintain good health. So not just minimum, good health. Mm-hmm. So we're definitely getting, and this is without supplementing. So this is just protein from our diet. But I think what's happened is that people have taken the message and they think that they have to add more protein into their diet, when really the important thing is to make sure that the protein foods that we're enjoying are a primary focus of our food. So at the moment, people tend to build their meals from the carbohydrate first. So they'll say, I'm going to have rice with, or pasta with, or a sandwich with. And just flipping that over to say, okay, what protein-rich, preferably plants. Okay,
yeah.
So we know that plant protein is much better for us for long-term health than animal protein. So if we can include legumes, beans, chickpeas, whole grains, mushrooms, nuts and seeds, they're all rich in protein. We can get all of the essential amino acids from these foods.
Yeah. And does that prevent us then from going for the croissant? You have a bowl of chickpeas, you then don't want the croissant.
That actually adding food into our diets, adding food to our plates, displaces the foods that we reach for when we feel starving.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of clients who come to me and they hardly eat anything. You know, they're so scared of putting on weight with a menopause. They're so worried.
That's a big one, isn't it?
It's really big. And so they end up eating things like a rice cake and a date. I mean, I had a client who actually, that was what she ate in the mornings until about 2 p.m.
Okay.
And then she would get to the evening and be absolutely starving. And she was actually, she noticed that she was feeling a bit off, and she was by no means overweight, but her like tone was changing. But, you know,
well, it's the fear, isn't it? Because your body's kind of changing and
trying to manage it.
Yeah, you're trying to manage it, exactly.
And so then what was happening in her case was that she was getting these big glucose spikes from the date, big glucose spike from the rice cake, no protein, no fiber, no nutrients to actually support her body.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we're trying to avoid. So building our plates with protein-rich plant foods first,
yeah,
making sure we also have some nice, colourful plants in there for the polyphenols, the phytochemicals that are really good for us.
What's a polyphenol?
And fiber. They're plant chemicals, yeah. So phyto-Greek.
Yeah.
So phytochemical just means a plant chemical we know are really good for us. They're anti-inflammatory, but they also support our gut microbiome. So having those on your plate first, and then have your starchy carbohydrates. Of course, we'll still be enjoying those, but try and focus on whole grains. Enjoy those at least every day. Most of us don't have any. I'm not a huge fan of white rice. I just think of all the things, like barley is so much better. But no, have it on occasion. But just remember that there are more nutritious options out there that
and
are better for us.
The general potato, I'm always thinking, I can't have that. I've got to have a sweet potato. Is that?
Well, actually, so interesting. Sweet potato has vitamin A, it has carotene, it has other things, beta carotene. But both potato and sweet potato are starchy root vegetables. But enjoying them cold, it turns some of that starch into the resistant starch, which is really good for our gut microbiome and causes less of a sugar spike, essentially, when you eat them. So this plant message was lost, I think. And now we have women in their 40s and 50s taking protein supplements and eating protein bars and adding protein left, right and centre and forgetting about fibre, which is the one that 90% of us are deficient in.
Yeah.
And we know supports the gut microbiome and we know reduces the impact of menopausal symptoms.
It became out of fashion, fibre, didn't it?
I think fibre, you know, anything that you're trying to say makes you have better poo isn't going to be vogue. I mean, it might be one day.
Yeah.
But fibre is it's a bit of an unsexy nutrient.
Yeah.
But it's the only one that most of us don't get enough of.
Okay.
No one in this country is protein deficient. And if it means that women are now eating like a plain chicken breast because they're so worried about their protein and that's their lunch, or it means that they're buying these pretty awful. I'm yet to find a good one on the market. Protein bars that are full of sweeteners and emulsifiers, and are just, I cannot see any benefit in eating them whatsoever. Instead of eating plenty of vegetables and plenty of lovely protein-rich plants, then I think we've missed a trick there. So I think that that is the biggest issue with that messaging. It's like, it's true that we need to focus on our protein to make sure we maintain that muscle mass, to make sure that we maintain all the immune function is really dependent on protein. Like, all of our immune system cells are made of protein.
I think women are so true. They're just trying to have a quick fix, aren't they? It's like with supplements and they're not, there's so many supplements. For example, women don't know what to take.
Yes.
So they've got cupboards full of it. I mean, are there supplements that you think really are amazing for, you know, the key symptoms like hot flushes?
Yeah. So it's a really interesting question. I think there isn't any evidence to support menopausal supplements as such.
Okay.
Yet. Okay. So I'm always going to say yet. The one that seems to be bucking the trend, despite me not really understanding how it's doing it, is collagen. So collagen supplementation in women postmenopausally seems to actually improve skin elasticity. So skin looks better, feels better, hair as well. Only really small trials yet. We're not 100% sure if that's going to hold up, but there's a positive trend there.
And is there a kind of brand, because I know, you know, I mean, this isn't a sales channel, but I tried a specific brand of collagen and it got my hair back to normal. Mm,
that's
so
good.
Are they all not equal? Is there a certain collagen to go for?
Yeah, well, this is where it becomes tricky, because technically collagen is just a bunch of amino acids. So it doesn't even make sense that it should work, because it gets broken down and then... So why is it any better than other?
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't know if there's like a specific brand or a specific formulation. I think keeping an eye out on what the science tells us as they keep doing more studies on this, and then finding a brand that works for you. So if you prefer liquid, great. If you prefer powder, great. But that is something that has helped, seems to be helping women with their skin and hair. The other thing, as I just mentioned, is fiber.
Yeah.
We don't get enough of it in our diet. Some people struggle to add fiber to their food.
Okay.
So sometimes I will recommend a fiber supplement like Indie Body, because it just helps people to get a bit more fiber in their day as they get used to cooking more vegetables, eating more fresh fruit.
Do they quite quickly feel better fed once they're having more fiber?
Yes.
And having a colourful diet.
Yes.
And all of
the,
yeah, they do.
So the change is like within 2 weeks you get people that they feel like a different person.
Yeah.
But that's because it impacts so many things. It impacts our gut health, our mental health. It impacts our ability to stay sharp and focused. It impacts our sleep.
Yeah.
So sleep, as you've already touched on, is a huge topic, and it's a huge issue for a lot of women.
And it's stressful because you're in a cycle that then you're getting panicky about not sleeping.
Yeah. And then you're looking at the clock and, oh,
exactly.
No, it's 1 o'clock.
Like, oh my God, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. The phone really shouldn't be in the room, but it is.
Yeah.
But then are there things that people can do, obviously like sleep hygiene, but there are any supplements that you've seen that are going to help?
So with sleep hygiene is more important than supplementing. So making sure that you're covering all those bases. Matthew Walker is like my favourite scientist on sleep. He's brilliant. And we know that certain things impact our sleep. So we know alcohol impacts our sleep. We know that caffeine impacts our sleep. So having a coffee after 2 p.m., if you're somebody who struggles to sleep, is probably not a good idea. We also know that the amount of movement you've had that day really impacts your ability to sleep. So if your body's had an opportunity to move throughout the day, it's more likely, you're more likely to sleep well that evening.
I can't have any caffeine anymore, literally. I can have maybe one decaf in the morning, but even that I'll have like once a month.
Yeah. So knowing what works for you as well, I basically am made of coffee.
You are Italian, that's true.
Knowing what works, but there are certain things like making sure that you don't do anything stressful an hour before bed, putting your phone away, not watching TV or the news. One of the women I work with, who are like, I just, my sleep is all over the place. Okay, what do you do at bedtime? I watch the 10 o'clock news and I go to bed. I'm like, well, the world is pretty stressful. So I'm not that surprised, right? So just these things that might seem obvious, but actually getting them into a routine takes time, and you have to get used to that as a new routine. That's really important. And then there are, with sleep, there are some natural supplements that are shown to help. Worth noting here that actually taking sleeping tablets isn't a good idea for long term.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work any better than cognitive behavioral therapy.
Oh, that's interesting.
So actually getting some CBT is probably going to be better overall. So sleeping tablets. But so what do we know works? So we know valerian root is very efficient with sleep. It actually helps to induce sleep. And we know that tryptophan can help quality of sleep. Now we can get tryptophan from food, but if you like to supplement with something, then something that contains valerian root and tryptophan could be really helpful.
Okay. That's super helpful. I think that's something a lot of women suffer with.
And yeah.
It gets into this cycle that you can't break.
Just make it occasional. Just make sure that you're not relying on these products to sleep every night, because that's problematic. So use it to make sure you get that really good rest one night, and then try and implement these daily changes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's other more serious conditions like hyperthyroidism that can really impact your sleep. So if it persists and it's something you just can't get to the bottom of, and you've done the sleep hygiene. Yeah. Get your thyroid checked, or get a checkup generally. One of my clients at the moment, we found out that they're not sleeping well at night because they actually go hypoglycemic in their sleep.
Right, okay.
So there's lots of different things that could be having an impact. And if the sort of very basic sleep hygiene, nutrition and movement aren't doing it for you, it's worth investigating, because sleep is so important for long-term health.
Because my thyroid is a bit down. Mm. So then once I started taking some of the thyroid, that helped slightly. So it's interesting. Oh, interesting. It's lots of different things, isn't it?
Yes, it is. More exercise. But we should prioritise sleep. Sleep is so important for longevity. So if we want to live a long and happy life, sleep is like up there. If I wasn't working in nutrition, I might be working in sleep, because it's really important, and it's important for people to prioritise it.
Yeah.
Getting a good bed as well. My bed is so comfortable.
So is mine.
I love my bed.
Brilliant. Well, thank you, Fed, for joining us. That was absolutely fascinating. And I hope that helps lots of you out there who will be going through perimenopause and even kind of preparing for the perimenopause. I hope that you have taken something away that will be beneficial.
Thanks so much, Georgie.